Hi, everyone. My name's Jane, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm a recovering jaywalker, too. It is so great to be here and to see all your wonderful smiles. And I'll tell you, just from meeting people since I've gotten here, I think we've got representatives from sea to shining sea here at Girlstock. And I also can't believe that I love the name of this, Girlstock, you know. And let me tell you, Woodstock ain't got nothing on us. I'll tell you another thing that's pretty cool. I think our rock star here is Polly P., and she is the Janis Joplin of Girlstock. And I happen to know that she went to high school with the same high school as Janis Joplin. So that's pretty cool. So anyway, I always like to invite Grace in at the beginning of my talk because to me, I firmly believe that the will of God will never take me where the grace of God won't protect me. And of course, getting behind the podium, we all become very vulnerable and emotional. And I just feel strength in your smiles and the love that I've received so far. And just thinking about grace, how, you know, it's the inner realization that we're already one with God. It's nothing that we have to work towards or, you know, push for. It just is there. We just have to tap into it. It's like this really cool undercurrent of life, you know, that offers us things like light and forgiveness and mercy and how amazing grace really is. And I also like to start with a prayer. So if right now you wouldn't mind, you know, closing your eyes, bowing your heads, and reciting the third step prayer with me, I sure would appreciate it. God, I offer myself to Thee, to build with me and to do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, so that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help, Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. May I do Thy will always. And Holy Spirit, let me step aside and please put the words in my mouth that You would have me say tonight. Well, all of us have a story, and as the Big Book tells us, sometimes our dark past is our greatest gift, and I'm here to share with you tonight. I feel like I'm a humble servant of Alcoholics Anonymous, commissioned to share with you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And I hope that I'm able to do that with the language of my heart. And it's such a miracle, just the fact that my heart remains open, and it hasn't closed down as a result of some of the things that I've been through. I'm sure you can all relate. And I also look out and I see a room full of miracles. This always blows my mind when I just look at the sea of beautiful women that most of us probably should be dead, you know, and yet we're like butterflies. We've come out of our cocoon and we're flapping our beautiful wings. And I'm so glad that all of us flapped our wings and we're here tonight. So give yourselves a hand for that. God promised us all a safe landing, but the passage isn't always calm. And throughout my story, I'll allude to step one. You know, we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. And I know that we all took that step, some of us more freely than others. Some of us had to suffer, you know, severely to get to that point. And I certainly am one of them. But I automatically feel a camaraderie with you because, you know, there's no measuring stick on pain, so to speak. We all have pain. We've all experienced it. Any one of you could be up behind this podium tonight telling your story. But tonight it's me, and I'm glad that I'm the first one Friday night so I can enjoy the rest of the weekend. But anyway, I'm here to celebrate this precious, life-saving, life-sustaining, life-giving gift called sobriety. And my story begins on, first of all, let me tell you about my home group. I'm from Tallahassee, Florida. I see some Tallahassees over there, yeah. Via New Jersey, I see some Jerseys over here. And my home group is Central Group 909, and I love the Sunday noon meeting. This is my favorite. I've been going to that meeting. That's my commitment meeting every time I'm in town now for the last 15 years. And yay! And and I'm really really happy to be here, especially this weekend. It's very timely for me, and I'm sure all of you are also experiencing the serendipity of this. God's timing is always right on, right? My sobriety date is September 24th, 1996, and so I'm coming up on the big 2-0, and that is only because of God's grace once again. Thank you, God. And the having wonderful sponsors throughout the years. I always like to mention my sponsor. It was an old-timer named Diz T, who passed 2 years ago, and he was the one who introduced me to my current sponsor, who is Miss Amanda Magnolia Brown, and I'm so grateful to have her in my life with her love and her wisdom and her guidance. And there are also so many other special people here tonight, so, you know, again, I couldn't be happier. So my story begins November 20th, 1962, which is the day that I was born. And as I said before, I was born in a little town called Caldwell, New Jersey, and it's about 20 minutes outside of Manhattan. And so it was a beautiful town to grow up in. I had this great childhood. I'm from a big Irish Catholic family. That being said, I think alcoholism, I'm genetically predisposed to alcoholism, put it that way. I mean, when I look at my family line, it's not in my my family of origin, but tons of relatives, and yeah, it's just one of those things, you know. And I also have a great set of parents. My mom and dad just celebrated 58 years of marriage last month. And so I grew up in a really loving family, and that's one of the amazing things about all of us alcoholics, right? We hear all these different stories. Some people had really tragic upbringings. Some bad things happened when they were growing up, and they were able to, you know, get over it and, you know, bounce back and move on. And then those of us, honestly, I had nothing bad happen to me in my childhood. There is no reason on earth for me to have become an alcoholic. I had a loving family. You know, I grew up close to the church. I loved the Virgin Mary. I loved, you know, I always felt like God was looking down on me and so I always wanted to be a good girl. And we went to Catholic schools, and I'm one of those Catholics that had a great experience growing up Catholic. I had great nuns in my life. I still do, and great priests too. And I really loved, you know, going to Mass on Sunday. So I always had God in my life. I went to Catholic schools, and in elementary school I was always vivacious and energetic and the class clown and, you know, mischievous but in a good way. And then my rebellious years didn't really kick in until high school. I should mention, too, that my mom was a stay-at-home mom, and I have four siblings who are now my best friends, but it wasn't always that way. I'm really proud. I always mention my dad because he was actually favored to be the first ever to break the four-minute mile, and he missed it. Get this. It was 4.00.08. So, but that says a lot about my dad's sense of discipline and, you know, his work ethic. He was really, you know, an amazing guy, but he expected a lot out of all of us. So from childhood, there was no doubt in my mind we were all going to college, kind of thing. And my grandparents were off the boat from Ireland and Scotland, so they had that work ethic too of, you know, getting better and doing better for the next generations. I went to an all-girl Catholic high school, and I graduated in 1981, and there were only 81 girls in my high school class. I always mention, because I always want to honor her too, but one of my close friends was Whitney Houston. And, of course, you know, her story is just so devastating. But she too was like the all-American kid in high school. You know, it was like you never saw that coming either. She was funny and wonderful, and you know, this disease took her down and took her down hard. So I always like to you know, mention her because she's another great example of somebody who this shouldn't have happened to. And the first time I took a drink, I was 14 years old. My older cousin, who was 18, we went to the movies, and we saw, I know I'm definitely dating myself with this, but it was the original Star Wars. And I remember she had a big bottle of rum, and we had, you know, Cokes, and she kept dumping the rum into my Cokes, and it was just like, I never had that feeling before. You guys know that feeling, that warm, tingly feeling when it's going down. And as I looked at the big screen, I had never seen anything like that before. You know, it was like, woo! Oh, man, this is cool. I was flying right next to Han Solo in that Millennium Falcon. I mean, and it's so symbolic, too, because it really took me out of this world, placed me into another galaxy on a whole different plane, and I mean, I loved it. I just loved it. It was almost like my seat was going along with the, you know, the rocket ship. But anyway, and then of course I got deathly ill. I mean, for the first time I drank a lot. She had three bottles of rum. I probably drank like more than a half because there were only four of us at the movie together. So. Anyway, so I got so sick, and it was like, I wasn't one of those that was like, oh my God, I can't wait to do it again. I was like, I am never doing this again. And so that was my first, you know, experience with alcohol. And the other thing, and I tell this because for identification purposes, I'm not one of those that felt like there was something inherently missing in my life. Like, alcohol at that point didn't fill any void for me. It was just kind of temporarily fun. And then, you know, and then it wasn't. So, you know, you hear all stories. So I just thought I'd mention that part in my story, that I never had that feeling that I didn't fit in or that, you know, I was different. I always fit in. I was always popular. My parents always told me how smart I was and how beautiful I was and, you know, and I was going to be something and all that. So, but my self-esteem was definitely low. You know, it was back in the, especially in my high school years, it was like the disco era, and all my friends were the Italians with the ton of makeup and the big hair, and I was this skinny, white, freckled face Irish kid with frizzy, curly hair kind of thing. So I definitely suffered from low self-esteem, but that was it. And then, that's when my rebellion occurred, and it was mostly with my mom. Who, you know, I think my mom really wanted me to, like, be a nun or something. And so, you know, all of a sudden I started to just do things that would rebel against her. Like, you know, I started dating, like, hippie guys with, like, hair down to their butts and, you know, or, you know, punk rock looking guys kind of thing. It was all sort of my little inner rebellion. But it was also hard to figure out, right? Because we're women, you know, it's like, what? How do we, in this culture that the media kind of controls so much, like what women are supposed to be like and what they're supposed to do, and it's almost like we're controlled by this outside force, who are we supposed to be? And I was really confused, you know, I didn't know. Do I, you know, settle down and get married or whatever? But from a young age, I felt like I wanted to be adventuresome and I wanted to see the world. So anyway, my first step into that was college, and I went to Manhattan College, which is actually in the Bronx, and let me tell you, it was definitely a case of like this sheltered, you know, little Catholic schoolgirl that was let loose in the biggest, baddest, wildest city on earth, and let me tell you, I tore that city up from the get-go. And I went to college with mostly, it's a Catholic college, and I went to college with mostly kids that went to private high schools like I did, and so I saw them all going crazy and bonkers, and it was like, well, I might as well do that too. That's just what we do. We're all sowing our wild oats kind of thing. But from the outset, I remember that's when I started to love alcohol and what it did and the whole social aspect of it. And what it did for me was it made me, who was always wanted to be extraordinary, it made me like double extraordinary. It made me like amplified extraordinary. And I loved that feeling. I loved getting out on the dance floor and dancing and being outrageous and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And I should mention too, I graduated second in my class from high school, so I had big aspirations to become, you know, a doctor, you know, maybe a lawyer, that dream. And very quickly, after my first semester of partying, was the first time that I started to see all that go away. You know, it was like, I don't want to work that hard. I want to party. And so I became a creative writing major and a French minor, and, you know, and I turned into, like, sort of this hippie chick. And I was, again, one of those, I went through a lot of self-discovery stuff, but anyway, I was happy and I was having fun, and first semester I put on 25 pounds. And I'm here to tell you it was not the food, it was definitely the beer and the good time, and like I said, and now remember, this was in the 1980s, New York City was the city of excess. And I turned into the queen of excess. I mean, it was everything all the time. My college was right on the last stop on the one train, so I had access to New York City, at, you know, 24/7. So anyway, I just look back at that time, and it was really, you know, fun. It was really fun. I know, I love it when sometimes alcoholics will say, "Jane, you think you were having fun." I'm like, "No, I was really having a lot of fun. I really was." And, I mean, this was the era of Studio 54, the tunnel, you know, the limelight. Yeah! I swear we were on a bar stool next to each other, Massoon! And so it was great. And I look back on those early days of my drinking with a lot of fondness, you know. It was crazy, but it was fun. And then I started to, you know, like, slowly but surely, some bad stuff started happening to me. I remember my dad was like, "You have to maintain a 3.0 average if you want to stay living in school." I'm not kidding. I got a 2.95, and they made me move home for a semester. That wasn't fun. So I, you know, of course, studied really hard so I could get back in my groove. So then I should mention some outside issues that were always floating around in New York City in the 80s. And I am a big believer in singleness of purpose, but you know, drugs are a part of my story, especially the one that you smoke that, like, makes drinking oh so much cooler, and then the one that you snort that makes you drink quicker and harder and faster and dance like Janet Jackson and woo, you know. So they were a big part of my story too. But I have to say that alcohol was my true love. I never did any of those. It was always alcohol that led me to that stuff. And I always like to explain my take on that. Like, I really believe that addiction and alcoholism is a disease of the brain that translates into abnormal behaviors. And we all know what those abnormal behaviors are, right? Like, writing bad checks. Like waking up next to somebody and you're like, "Whoa, who are you?" Dancing like a total fool, ripping your clothes while you're on the dance floor, writing bad checks. I think that I mentioned that one. You know, just bad stuff. Bad stuff. And for me, going to the ATM, getting a bunch of money and scoring some of that stuff was part of my story. And So anyway, just wanted I didn't want to lie from omission. I had to mention that. It definitely plays a big part in my alcoholism. And I should say, too, that I really had no notion that that was my problem. I just thought I was a normal kid at that time in college going crazy. That's what we all do, you know. But I definitely was getting tired. So junior year, because I had that little French thing going on, I decided to make my first geographic change, and I moved to France. I spent a semester abroad, and I thought, okay, now I'm going to get serious. I'm a junior. I'm going to straighten up my act. I'm going to get serious about school. And I went to France, and I lived with a French woman and her son, and they had a 19-year-old nanny who was also a college student, French college student there. And her name was Myriam, and I lived in this little town called Nantes, and it was New York all over again. Me and Miriam just ripped that town up. And she knew everybody, and she was wild. So it was great, and thank God that was pass-fail, because, man, I just passed. But I also had a great opportunity to travel. I backpacked through Europe that summer, which was also a lot of fun. And I remember it was so funny because I had my train ticket, right? I had that. And then I had $300 for a month and a half, you know? And I remember I spent 100 of it in London getting my hair done first off. And then like the other remainder in Amsterdam loading up. And yeah, it was really, a lot of fun. And it's that too, I look at those days in amazement, like, man, party people are magnets for other party people. I just got along, people were inviting me to stay in their homes, I slept on, you know, park benches, beaches, whatever. I mean, I don't know how we did that, but I had a great time, and I went to like 11 countries. And it was really, you know, fantastic. And again, I was still having a good time. So I moved back to New York, and it was my senior year, and I'm like, again, the same thing. Okay, this time I'm getting really serious, I'm straightening up my act, I'm gonna, you know, everything's gonna be cool, I gotta prepare for the real world. Well, we all know what happened, you know, bad stuff again. I started dating one of the biggest dealers on campus, and, you know, whatever. So anyway, I graduated from college, and I have to mention this too, because I always had like this innocent kind of look about me, and I was all very manipulative, I could talk my way out of a brown paper bag, I got away with so much stuff. So I still was under the impression, you know, I come from a good family, I'm like this protected princess that, you know, nothing really super bad is ever going to happen to me, because I can, you know, talk my way out of it. And it worked for a really long time. And so I ended up getting, when I graduated, I always jammed at midterms and finals and somehow did great. But I graduated, I got a job teaching high school. And I moved to a city called Hoboken, New Jersey. Woo! Right across the river from the city that was so big and bad. I didn't want to get too far away from it. And Hoboken at that time was all young people. Like, it was just a really cool place to live. And it was on. It was on again. I'm going to fast forward through my party days. I'm hoping that you guys are getting it. You know, everywhere I went, I had resolved to, you know, do something different, and it always fell back into the same patterns. Now, I always chose drinking men. Many of us know what that's about, or drinking women, whatever your preference, but you had to be a heavy drinking guy if you wanted to hang out with me. And as a result, I would become incapable of acting in a way that would preserve my dignity, and I started doing things that I never thought I would do. I started having like bad semi-consensual sex, then, you know, that comes along with that. You know, and then I would wake up in a haze, and then I would do it all over again, because drinking diluted that for me, and it just kind of made it all bearable, and it became this weird cycle. And it was really sad when I look back on it, you know. I mean, it was like, that wasn't me, that wasn't the way I was raised, that wasn't my morals. And this is at the point in time where I saw my morals slipping away, you know, one by one. I got into a relationship with a married man. When I was teaching high school, he was a teacher there too. And, you know, I mean, we would go out drinking at lunchtime. Then I would, you know, do some on the overhead projector mirror and, you know, I mean, just crazy stuff. And I look back and I'm like, how did I get through that? And then it's like, oh yeah, that stuff on the overhead projector helped me get through that. And I really, you know, I got away with everything, though. I had this crazy work ethic. Like, I could party hard, but I had to show up for work. So I would be up all night, party and shower, and then go to work. And it was really, you know, it was unbelievable how I managed that part in my life. You know, it's amazing that something terrible didn't happen to me earlier on. So anyway, I did that, believe it or not, for 3 years. I taught high school, And finally, you know, bad stuff was happening all around me. I was, you know, all of a sudden my world started to, you know, crumble. And a friend of mine who was a high school teacher said, Jane, I just taught in Japan for a year on my sabbatical. I think you should do that too. You need to get away from the scene here. You need to get away from New York. You need to start fresh somewhere. So there's a you can interview for this job, and it's a great company, and you could teach over in Japan. And because of my love of travel, I was all over that. Like, yeah, I'm moving to Japan. That's great. So no joke, I interviewed in New York. It was the guy that was interviewing came and interviewed in New York and Chicago and L.A. and Miami. And, you know, and on the interview, we had a really good interview, went out partying that night. I got the job. And the next thing that happened was 2 weeks later, I was on a plane to Japan. And I remember, you know, my family was, by this point too, my family was, had it with me. I would embarrass them at family functions. There was a wedding once. Oh God. So anyway, they stopped inviting me to family weddings. And, you know, it really hurt. And like, that's when I started to do stuff like drink at my family, if you know what I mean. Like, oh, you guys, you know, you don't get it. And I'm a good person. And, you know, if you don't love me, well, guess what? My party friends love me, and they're my family, you know, that kind of thing. And so I thought, okay, I'll move to Japan. My family will really miss me. And when I come home, everything will be great again. And so I went to Japan, and I remember the guy sitting next to me on the plane was like, man, that's pretty wild. You're just, like, picking up and moving to Japan, and, you know, I mean, do you speak any Japanese? And I was like, yeah, I know how to say domo arigato, Mr. Roboto. And then that other line from Laugh-In, remember, saki to me. And that was about it. And so anyway, I got to Japan, and it ended up being a great experience, you know. Again, my resolve was, okay, I'm going to be serious over here, you know. Yeah, right. So I ended up hanging out with crazy, crazy Australians and Brits and Canadians that just, in Japan too, this was back in the 80s, late 80s in Japan when it was booming, so there were tons of English teachers over there, and we got away with so much because we were foreigners. Those poor Japanese people, we were like tornadoes when we moved into those places, and that's really, that represents the turn in my drinking. That's when, you know, I started to know that I needed alcohol to keep me level. I did some crazy things when I was over there too. Once again, you know, I remember I used to call home at like 5 a.m. drunk to my parents, you know, like, you know, and I think it was like 3 p.m. here. So they would be like, what the heck? You know, anyway, I remember one of my closest friends who I just went to visit in London a couple of years ago, she ripped a page out of her diary to give me, and it was funny, but it was sad, and it was very telling, because I remember that period, and it said, my friend Jane decided to cut back on her drinking, which means she didn't drink for lunch on Thursday. And it said something else, but, you know, anyway... So, but anyway, that was really, that was when I knew that I had a problem, because I started to take little nips in the morning to get even, and again, in Japan, you could get away with that stuff. Like, and I worked for Time Life Educational Services, so they contracted teachers out to big companies like Toyota and Honda. So I worked for Toyota most of the time, and I worked with the men who were about to be shipped overseas. So it was an intensified English class. So I had to eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner with these guys, and then go out drinking with them every night. And I'll tell you, that was when the real cultural exchanges went down too, you know. And so I had a great time there, but that was it marks my demise, because when I went for a year and I ended up staying for three. you know, there were some great things that happened. I got to travel a lot over, you know, in Southeast Asia and stuff. But when I came home, that was when I was like, I have got to change this time. I've got to do something different. And I didn't. I fell right back into the same trap as usual. I got my first DUI. And I had a friend who lived down in the Florida Keys who owned a restaurant. And he said, why don't you come down and, you know, and straighten up your act. And you don't need a car down here. And everything will be cool. So I literally went to the Florida Keys with the intention of getting sober. Right! Yeah, right! That didn't work out too well. As a matter of fact, it didn't work out well at all, because that was when that incomprehensible demoralization kicked in. That was when, you know, I was always happy, and, you know, I loved vodka and I loved beer, so that was my combo. So I remember, you know, I used to, well, through all the years, I always had to drink really good vodka, like Stolichnaya, you know, whatever. Now they have, I mean, so many cool flavors and stuff. I miss that. I kind of, you know, kind of bummed about that. But I loved Stolichnaya, and then I loved shots. I was a shot queen. I loved, you know, Wild Turkey. I loved tequila. I loved shots. And I loved beer, as I said. That's especially Guinness. That's the Irish in me. But at this point in time down in the Keys, I remember I had a bottle of Popoff vodka. You know, that's what I had, that's all that I could afford. And then I started smoking the stuff that I used to snort. You know what I'm talking about. And I got down to like literally like 110 pounds. And I had the proverbial looking in the mirror and looking at this shell of the woman that I once was. And in many ways, I wanted to die. It was like I was on the road to self-destruction. By now, my family wasn't even talking to me. And, you know, it was almost like I wanted to kill myself, but I didn't have the courage to do it. So I was going to go out in flames, you know. I was going to, like, you know, explode my heart or, you know, drink myself to something like that. But I really didn't care if I lived or died. It was really sad, sad, sad situation. But when I saw myself in the mirror that day, I had a little bit of an enlightenment, and I picked up the phone and I called a cousin who was in Fort Lauderdale, and I said, you know, Betty, I know I'm going to die. I'm like going to die within a couple of days. I just feel it. And she knew that I was kind of had this witchy intuitive thing, so she said, come and, you know, you can live with us. So I did, and she had, I think back, she had three little kids at the time, I mean, but I really feel like she was one of the women that saved my life. And so I went, and then I started to get it together. People were telling me about AA. I didn't want to hear anything about AA. I got this, you know how it is. I got this, you know. And so I started to really try to limit my drinking. And so it's amazing how I went through, you know, withdrawals, but they weren't bad. It was weird. And then I was able to limit my drinking to, like, weekends. So I went from all-day consumption to weekends, which is kind of weird. But I'm weird like that. Like, even with smoking, I've always been like that. Like, I could put them down, smoke them, whatever. But I couldn't put it down when I was in Japan. So it was like almost the change of environment helped me to change that a little bit. So I figured, I don't need AA. So then, but of course, every time I drank till it was blackout and something terrible happened. And then I would have to recover and, you know, try and figure out what to do next. But so at this point in time, I met a guy, and he was, he actually lived in Europe at the time. And he was really funny and cool and adventurous. And I was working for a travel agency. And so he was in town, and he wanted to go down to the Florida Keys to check out some of the water sports stuff, because he was starting an adventure tour package kind of deal. So we went down to the Florida Keys this one weekend, and boom, first tiki bar that we hit, we went in and started drinking. And we did that. We proceeded all the way down to our destination. So we were bombed by the time we got down there. And I remember we went to this bar, the Brass Monkey, and we danced that night and, you know, had a great time. And then we went down and watched the sunset by the old 7 Mile Bridge. And I thought, wouldn't it be a great idea to go back to the bridge and watch the sun come up? So we got in the car and got, like, you know, a cooler of beer and had some weed, and we were like, yeah, let's just go hang out down there and have some fun. So I remember we decided to go back to the 7 Mile Bridge. Now, we went. I remember seeing this sign that said authorized vehicles only. So I figure, oh, well, vehicle, let's go, you know. And so we went down the bridge road. And I remember, all I remember is going around this little curb. And the next thing was just this thunderclap and this shoot of lightning that just went through my whole being. And I was like, oh my God, what happened? What happened? And when I looked up, it was just dark and smoke, I remember my ankle was just like, oh my God, because I tried to break, and I put my hand down on my ankle, and when I pulled my hand up, it was just covered in blood, and I felt the bones in my ankle, and I was like, oh my God, oh my God. And I remember, you know, I remember Max next to me, and he looked like he hit his head and he was passed out. And I was just freaking. I was like, how are we going to get out of this? Oh my God. Nobody, how is anyone going to find us here? And how are we going to get out of this? And oh my God. And I was breathing really heavy because I was having a really difficult time taking breaths. It was like, like every breath was a conscious effort. And I started saying my prayers. And I grabbed Max's hand, and it started to turn cold. And I realized that he wasn't breathing. And that he was dead. I still can't talk about it without crying. It's like, I can't believe it happened. It's so surreal. So anyway, I want to try and get through this part as fast as I can, but I remember there was, I was literally on my last breaths, but I wanted to go. There was no way. I'm like, how am I going to live with myself knowing that this precious life is abbreviated because of me? How am I going to move on with this? I mean, there's no way. God, please take me too. It didn't take too long, but I remember seeing the blue lights coming, and I remember the police officer was so kind and loving, and I just was like, how come you're being so nice to me? I'm like a drunk driver that killed somebody. And he was like, hang in there, we're going to get you out of here, everything's going to be okay. And I remember that saw, they had to cut me out of the car, and I remember just screaming for him. And so anyway, let me get through this part. But I got heliported to the hospital in Miami, and the next thing I remember is my dad and one of my brothers at my bedside. And the first words that I said to my dad when I looked at him was, Dad, it didn't happen because I was drinking. And I remember that look on my dad's face like, oh my God, Janie, what is it going to take? So anyway, I was in the hospital. For 5 months, I broke my neck at C1, C2, which is the same fracture that Christopher Reeve sustained. So it's a miracle that I'm even here. I mean, a third of the people that get that fracture are paralyzed, a third are brain damaged, and a third are killed instantly. And so how I'm here is, I'm not kidding when I say we're all miracles. I definitely should be dead. And I spent those first, you know, weeks in the hospital wondering, like, why am I here? Why did God leave me here, you know? And I have to figure that out. And I remember, too, I knew that I was going to prison. I knew I was. You know, I had a previous DUI. I actually had two DUIs before this happened. And, So what happened at the bridge was they had just filmed that movie, True Lies, with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and they blew the bridge up, and I crashed right into that barrier that was, guarding, and then over the other side. If I hit that thing any harder, I would have gone into the water. So there were all sorts of things, like, you should plead, you know, not guilty, that road should have been blocked off better, whatever. I didn't want to hear any of that. I was like, you know what? I was guilty as heck. I am taking responsibility for this. There's no way I'm going to sleep at night by getting up and saying, not guilty. I was guilty. So I knew I was going away. And I just, you know, I had to, it was weird. First I had to get better physically. Then I had to get better emotionally. I had to start on some kind of journey emotionally because I was literally just dead inside. I was a shell of the woman that I once was. And that was when I first started hearing, you know, opening my mind up to AA. And it was my father who said, Janie, we had a family meeting. If you don't get any help, we have to move. You can't be in our lives anymore. We can't go through this anymore. You're out of the woods right now. You're not going to die. Everything's cool. We love you. We hope that you make the right choice. But if you decide you're going to drink again, we can't be in your life. And I was just like, oh, great. And then because there was still, talk about powerlessness, I still was figuring out how I was going to drink again at that point. Even that wasn't enough. You know, it was this weird denial, right? Like, it didn't happen because I was drinking. Like, really? So anyway, but I went to a couple meetings at the, when I first got out of bed, I had like a wheelchair, a sliding board, and I went down to my first AA meeting, and I was not impressed. You know, I was just like, man, no way, these people. This is a freaking cult. You guys know what I'm talking about. Like, all this God stuff? Really? So at this point, I was mad at God. I didn't believe there was a God. This was when that part of my journey happened. It was like, if there's a God, I don't want to have anything to do with him because he knows I'm a good person. And why would this happen to me? And of course, why would this happen to Max? I remember the Catholic priest would come in to give me communion and I would be like, please leave. Please leave. You know, and then I, of course, knew that I found out from the attorney that I was looking at 15 years in prison. And that's pretty scary. So, you know, no wonder I wanted to drink again. You know, like 15 years in prison. What? So I pled guilty. I just wanted to get sentenced. And I did. I got sentenced to 5 years in prison, followed by 10 years of probation. And I'll tell you something. I see one of my Keys friends is here. I actually had a really cool experience. I spoke at a gratitude dinner down in the Florida Keys in November. And she works for the court system, and she spoke to the judge that sentenced me, and the judge came to the gratitude dinner. It was unbelievable. It was unbelievable. And, man, let me tell you, I got 5 years prison, 10 years probation, and I had to go to an AA meeting every day. That was part of my probation, 10 years. Even my probation officer was like, I've never heard of this before. And I lost my license for life. She was harsh, you know, but she was fair. She was fair. And I was able to give her a hug and just tell her that she really saved my life. I know she did. I know she saved my life. Because if I didn't go to prison, I would have definitely drank again. So that was really cool. And it was sort of like a full circle thing. And I've had a lot of those in sobriety. So prison. I met some of the coolest women in my life in there. So any of you that bring meetings into prison, God bless you, because that was when AA first started to get attractive to me. I shouldn't say the first, but it was a continuation. I really first started to get into AA just before prison. A group in St. Pete really helped to save my life, too. And they all came down to my sentencing. And then in prison, it was women from Tallahassee that came up, and I wanted what they had. It's as simple as that. They were funny and cool and loving, and I realized that AA wasn't a bunch of nerds. It was a bunch of really cool people that would be dead if they didn't get sober. And then I did some cool stuff when I was in prison, we started a literacy program, and then the last 3 years I did I helped women who were preparing for their GED. So, and I also did a lot of AA. And my sponsor from St. Pete on the outside, I worked the steps with her through writing. And I also had a couple of crucial moments in prison. I'll tell you about one of them. I remember it was my first year in prison, and it was Easter week. And I remember that there was a Catholic priest that would come in once a month to say Mass. And he was really cool. Actually, there were two really cool priests. But the first one, I remember I went to confession because it was Easter week. And I was telling him my sins. And he was a really cool priest, young, and he kind of looked like the Sacred Heart of Jesus. You know, he had like the beard, and he was handsome, and he was cool. And I remember after this confession, he like looked up at me, and his chin was trembling, and I was like, oh, look, he's crying, you know. And then I realized very quickly that he wasn't crying. He was angry. He was mad. He was shaking. And he said, Jane, if I could, I would take you by the collar and throw you up against that wall and slap you silly, because every time you come to confession, it's the same sin. And every time you leave, I tell you, God forgives you. You know, so who do you think you are to not accept God's forgiveness? You know, I keep telling you, your sin's forgiven. It's thrown out there into the sea of forgiveness. You keep reeling it back in. Do me a favor. Don't waste my time anymore. Don't come to Mass anymore. Don't do any of this until you come to terms with God's forgiveness. And more than that, you start living a life of redemption. And I was like, whoa. I couldn't believe it. But honestly, I mentioned that because something in me shifted that day. Something in me shifted, and I started to really become alive again. And then the second cool priest, this was 3 years later, after Mass one day, he said, ladies, I just want to share with you, I'm an alcoholic in recovery, and I got permission from the warden to do fifth steps with you. And I was like, wow, that's pretty good. And he was Irish from New Jersey. And I was like, that's a sign. So I'm going to go to confession and do my fifth step, kill two birds with one stone. How cool is that? So that's what I did, and then I started to experience that freedom that a fifth step, a good, thorough fifth step offers. I started to feel more of a member of the human race and less of a freak, and everything started to get a little better. Even in prison, one can be free, if you know what I mean. And So I did, the 5 years, that I had to do in Florida, it's 85%. So it was like 4.3 years I did in prison. And I could talk about that for a long time. I started to repair the relationships with my family, even though I wasn't too happy with them. Because they must have had a family meeting and they said, we love you and we're so proud of you and you're going to your meetings and you're committed to stay sober, but we are not sending you any money. And, some friends always laugh when I imitate my mother's voice, but she's like, you think I'm going to be sending you money so you can drink soda and eat potato chips while you're in there? I don't think so. You know? And if you know prison life, you know that you have to have some money coming in or it's really embarrassing. And for me, I didn't have any money coming in, and it was very humiliating. But I needed that. And I one of my big resentments right now is that I didn't write Orange is the New Black, because let me tell you, I recently joked with someone that, you know, I have a great name for a chapter of that book. It's like, I'm nobody's boo because I'm a broke ass bitch. But I managed, and it was, like I said, very humbling. And the whole prison experience is very humbling, you know. Again, talk about powerlessness. I mean, you know, you don't have say in anything you do. You lost all your rights. You have to do exactly what they tell you to do, when to do it. And it's so humiliating. I mean, just imagine, you know, my dad used to come see me once a year. And just imagine, right before you walk out into that waiting area, you have to stand there naked with your hands up against the wall, and then they tell you to bend over, spread your cheeks, and cough. I mean, how humiliating is that? That's like animalistic. And I had to do that and then walk out like, hi, Dad! You know? So they just do it to demean you, disgrace you, debase you, and humiliate you, and it works. But I'm one of those that's thankful for it, because that's exactly what I needed. And, let me move a little forward now too. When I got out of prison is when I started to really try to rebuild my life. And I remember when I first got out, another thing is I had to see, another part of my probation besides going to AA every day. So I moved, and losing my license for life, I moved very close to the AA house in Tallahassee so I could walk to my meetings. And I also had to go to therapy once a month. And I'm going to cry because my therapist is here right now. And Barbara, will you stand up? Stand up! Yay! She's going to be so mad at me for doing that, but I always thank her. And she said the last time I did it, she goes, it wasn't me, it was God. It was God. And I know that. It was definitely God. But it was God who put her in my life. And he was one of the many angels that was there waiting for me at every turn in the road. And she was the first one that I went to that believed in me, that gave me hope for the future, that ignited that fire, that I wasn't useless and worthless and done and finished. She was like, you're just beginning. You're just beginning. And she was the one who really steered me down the road that I took and that I'm still on today. So anyway, I love her. And I had other people that believed in me too, and eventually my life started to come together. Again, I'm so grateful for all those people, all those angels that God put in my life. And so the first job that I got, I always like talking about this too, was I was a housekeeper in a hotel. As you can imagine, it's difficult to get a job when you're a felon. And so I got a job, a housekeeping job, and I thought it was the best job in the world. And then I made it to the front desk. I was a front desk clerk. And I was making $7 an hour, you know, and I have 3 degrees from college. Talk about humbling. But I'll tell you something, I loved that job, and that was just what I needed, and I'm so grateful that I had that. And it taught me so much about handling money, and that was when I started to make my financial amends, because for me, financial amends were so important. And I'll tell you something, making $7 an hour, I paid off my parents the $15,000 that they got for the attorney in less than 5 years. So that was pretty cool. And I also decided, thanks to Barbara, to give school a shot, to go back to school. So when I was in prison, I was like, what am I going to do? I just want to live a life of love and service. I actually thought that I coined that phrase. And so what better job than to become a social worker? So I went back to school, and I didn't get accepted the first time. I didn't get accepted the second time because of my felony, but the third time I finally got in. My letter landed in the right hands. Not only did I get into Florida State University College of Social Work, but I got an assistantship scholarship. So I worked full time and I went to school full time, and I'll tell you, I don't know how I did that either without chemicals. I mean, and without driving. I mean, so I had to go to an AA meeting every day, and then I had to be at work. I've worked full time and then I went to school at night, and I did it, and I did it for 2 years straight. And then I ended up my first job was with the Department of Children and Families, so I had to go through like waivers to get permissions. And I just remember, like, people like Barbara were saying, just don't take no for an answer. Just keep trying. Somebody will hear your story and be honest. And I have to tell you, I was always honest about what happened to me. I never lied. I always put it on applications. I was like, and then I would look people right in the eye and I would say, where would any of us be without forgiveness? Please, can I have a second chance? And more times than not, people were like, yeah, I think so. Cool. I want to be a part of this. I believe in you. And that made me want to go and do it. And I did. And so my first job, I worked in a detox. So I was working with Alcoholics and Addicts during the day. And at night, I worked where Barbara worked, at the Addiction Recovery Center. And again, I was working with addicts and alcoholics, and I was also working with the mentally ill. And all of a sudden, these beautiful things just kept happening to me. I mean, it's just amazing when I think about it. And bad stuff happens too in life. You know, we all know that. But thank God that I have this 12-step program to help me through those times. And I know that when I stumble on this path called life, that the answer is only 12 steps away. It really is. I mean, it never fails. And I know that when things are not going wrong, it's when I'm putting my will between me and God. You know, I know it's my ego coming back in, and I sense it and I feel it, and I know I have to turn it over. And, you know, that's just the way we roll. And then I tried getting my teaching certification back, and they told me I would never teach again. Well, guess what? Then I got a call from the College of Social Work, and they wanted me to be an adjunct professor and teach a class every Monday night. Guess which class? Chemical dependency. So I started teaching, and I did that for about 2 years, and sure enough, the call came from the dean, and he asked me if I was interested in a full-time faculty position. I was like, what? So of course I said yes, and I've been, I just got my first promotion, and I'm now an associate teaching professor at the College of Social Work at Florida State University. It's just unbelievable. And I say all this stuff not to toot my own horn or anything, believe me, because it's hard for me to do that, but I also got some pretty cool awards, like I won Professor of the Year a couple of years ago, and then the National Association of Social Workers named me Social Worker of the Year, and I'm here to say that there's tons of service work to do inside the program, but also outside the program, and I also am involved in a student organization called To Write Love on Her Arms. It's for students who are experiencing depression or have experienced suicidal ideations or are having gender identity issues or any of that. And it's just great. It's like their own little support group. And I love working with those students. And I also, my life is amazing. And I know I'm running out of time, so I'm going to wrap it up. So anyway, being powerless over alcohol, I just want to say that, again, the depths of our bottoms are unique to all of us, right? It took me what it took me. And I remember not even in the beginning, and even it's still, I'm going to be honest, it still happens sometimes now. It's like, you know, these little glimpses of like, you know, I can handle this. You know, am I really an alcoholic? And I know that that's my, you know, my thinking is warped. And I know that, like, I try and take things back and I try and control things, but I've gotten really good at realizing when it happens and turning it over again. And the one thing that we all have in common is that this principle of surrender, we've all experienced it. We've all had to surrender. And I accepted defeat and I felt totally beat. I mean, humiliated. I was licked. The fight in me was over. But the beautiful part of that was it was mitigated by the fact that the fight was over, you know? Like, I didn't have to fight this anymore. Turn it over. That's one of those beautiful counterintuitive wisdoms. You know, you have to live in order to die, or die in order to live. And to me, that's kind of what step one is. I really had to die to my old self in order to be reborn into this new person as a result of this extreme psychic transformation that I had to undergo. And powerlessness. Sometimes I feel like I'm powerless over powerlessness, if you know what I mean. You know? I mean, I really am. But I knew that I had to drop the mask. I knew that I had to stop rationalizing. I knew that I had to break through that wall of self-deception that we all have. I knew that I had to do some deep soul-searching. I mean, I had to go on this major mining expedition when I was doing step one. And I did, and thank God. And I wasn't one to fake it till I made it. I really felt like I needed to do a ton of reading. And I was in prison, so I really didn't have much else to do, to tell you the truth. So I did that. I did just that. And when I took step one, I took it, and I really meant it. And the honesty is the biggest part of that. You know, that's what, to me, step one is all about honesty. Getting honest with ourselves. This is an honest program, you know. There's no edging it, skirting it. It's like you got to just face everything head on. And as a result of that, and then the preceding steps, you know, my life has just gotten so great. I just shared with you about the job that I love. The biggest problem that I have still, I think, is with resentments, and I have this great prayer that I love, that another nun gave me, Sister B, that I love to read at this. So I always share this. God, help me to look with soft eyes upon all who are part of my days. Break through the barriers of my scrutinizing views. Transform my inner landscape into a peaceful place of acceptance. Pull back my projections and criticisms. Replace my mean measurements and my biased expectations with an openness that allows others just to be. Cleanse me of everything that clouds my perceptions and blocks the sunlight of your spirit. And I am the luckiest girl in the world. I have the best life today. If there are any newcomers, you know, let me just tell you, please hang in there, get somebody's number. The miracle, if it hasn't happened yet, well, the miracle is that you're here, first of all, but also just hang in there because it's unbelievable. When you just keep living the right way and doing the right things, blessings just keep coming down and keep happening. I'm so happy that this is a program that if we practice the principles in all our affairs, that we can be an example to others. It's about attraction rather than promotion. And I love that. I love that. And it's never too late to be the person that God really meant for you to be. That's the other thing that I love, you know. And it's like we all have this big do-over. And I've been able to do a lot of traveling. I love traveling. Traveling is my thing. As a matter of fact, you know, I've taken some great trips since I've been able to, since I've been off probation. And one of the greatest gifts in sobriety is that I have fallen in love. And now, I've never been married, I've never, nothing, it's unbelievable, but I have met the best man I've ever met in my life. And in less than 2 months, he'll be my husband. Yeah. And when I tell you, he is just, I mean, he is everything. He's gentle and kind and, you know, I can be the feisty one. He never gets his feathers ruffled. He's just perfect. And he's really, really hot too. You know, just looking. I thought I'd throw that in there. He also is in this program. He's got 32 years of sobriety, and he does more for AA than, you know, I could ever dream to do. He, you know, having 32 years sober and still doing what he does just blows my mind. And it I realized that the bar, my bar has to be raised. And, so yeah, that's happening. And he, he does. And his brother's engaged too. So. But the best part of it is that Polly P is going to be my mother-in-law. How cool is that? How cool is that? I mean, I am the luckiest woman on the planet Earth. And it's all really because of this program. And, you know, I remember, thankfully, all the work of the people that have helped me out. And I hope that I can be there to help anyone out. That's just what we have to do. Anytime anybody comes in contact with us, I really feel like, they need to leave different and better people because of our example and the love that we show them. I think Mother Teresa said something like that. So, the privilege of a lifetime is being just who you are. And I hope that you enjoy this weekend, love every minute of it. We've all chosen to take this new road to freedom. Let's have fun while we're doing it. And I want to close with the 12-step prayer, which I love. Okay. Dear God, my spiritual awakening continues to unfold. The help I have received, I shall pass on and give to others, both in and out of the fellowship. For this opportunity, I am grateful. I pray most humbly to continue walking day by day on the road to spiritual progress. I pray for the inner strength and wisdom to practice the principles of this way of life in all I do and say. I need you, my friends, and the program every hour of every day. This is a better way to live. Thank you.